Hi everyone. So thanks for coming to this session. My name is Joo-sung Kim, and I'm a software engineer at Pinterest. I'm in the big data platform team at Pinterest, and I mostly focus on problems related to data processing. It is great to be here talking about all the work that teams at Pinterest has been doing around the ecosystem of big data. And then today I am going to share how we have been building our self-service big data platform over the last 3 to 4 years, and then also what we are working on to improve on top of what we have right now, and also the lessons that we learned in the process to make this scale better. So this is the agenda for the talk. First, I will talk about what we are doing at Pinterest and what kind of problems that we're solving as a product, and also the engineering problems on the big data platform side that we where we support the product and also the business that we provide to our partners. And then in the process, I'll also talk about why data and then data processing is super important for us, and then go over the high-level overview of our data platform outside big data platform as well. Secondly, I'll touch upon what self-service means to us, and then why we push for self-service in our platforms. Then I'll be also talking a little bit about how we identified particular problems, and then how the process of making things work for our users, and then also an important lesson that we learned about visibility to make the platform scale better. So what is Pinterest? So how many of you use Pinterest at all? Probably none. No. Oh, there's too few. All right, that's really great. Pinterest, in a few words, it's a visual discovery engine. So users, or the pinners that we call them, are collecting ideas, objects, web pages, videos, images from the web, and then they bring them into our site and organize them into boards. And then the visual aspect is that let the users identify an image that is that represents the page, and then they bring them into us, and then that's where the visual discovery engine starts with. And then it's pretty much a words catalog of ideas. So all the ideas, objects that the users bring in, it will be used to also provide more other ideas or interests that other users are interested in. And then our mission is to help all the users who use Pinterest discover and do what they love. And then that's the products that we are building on top of. So this is pretty much a page. A pin is an object over there where you can save them from different web pages, or if you see them in our site or in our app, you can also save them into your own board. And then this is an example of a home feed. So the home feed is where you browse new ideas from boards or from interests or from topics that you're following or from users that you're following. And then every person's home feed is very different because we tailor them based on the interest and taste the users have shown in the activities in our service. A fun fact is that we are making more than 10 billion recommendations per day, and then we rank more than 20 million pins every second to power our products. Another good example of our product is search. So the search helps you also find new ideas where you didn't follow before, or but you need to you want to know about new ideas now. So you can search, for example, camping tips with kids, and then it will show you a lot of ideas, pins, and then also it will help you expand your interest or idea search by providing more interesting keywords to search for, and also If you click through those, it will expand your search, and then it will try to define your interest into a particular topic or pin or idea. Another great product for discovery is Pinterest Lens. So on Pinterest Lens, you can discover things that you cannot describe in words. So you could take a picture with our app, and then you can point to, for example, a dish. In this case, it's spaghetti. And then it will identify it's a spaghetti, and then it will show you ideas around like ingredients, new recipes, and then new dishes you can try as well that are relevant to your interest and to this picture or to this pin. So these are a few numbers that describe what or the current state of Pinterest is. We have about 175 billion pins in our service, and then our users have organized these pins into more than 3 billion boards. We have more than 250 million users visiting our site, using our app, using our services every month. And then we're ranking roughly or more than 20 million pins every second to power our products and business. And then we also have more than 600 engineers working on this discovery problem. So like as you can see from the product side, a lot of our product is relevant or it's based on the data that the users bring into the site, all the web pages, all the text that we get, all the image signals, and then as well as the behavioral data that the users are giving us. Like they look for a pin, they search for something, they like click through something. And then all these behaviors in our service will feed into our product through data, and then processing the data into our relevant products and recommendations. This is a quick overview of how the data platform looks like to power all the products that we have seen before. So to give you a quick overview of how data is flowing end-to-end, like, by the way, this is a very simplified picture, a diagram, so just keep that in mind. So we have all our web clients or app clients running on the user side, right? And then they make a lot of, or when users are browsing and then like looking at pins or looking at ads or doing some search, they create a huge amount of event streams. So they all go to our web fleet or API fleet, and then all the API calls that are made to our web fleet are also generating a lot of log streams or message streams. So we have a local logging agent called Singer that moves data from all these, or moves the log data from all these hosts and then move it to Kafka. And then after it's moved to Kafka, we have two pipelines that will move this data to into a place and a format that can be processed. So one thing is called Merced, which reads data from Kafka, like hourly or daily or in whatever cadence you want, and then puts them in S3, and then it registers that data set into our metastores. And then the other route where data flows is the streaming systems. So we have streaming systems that ingest data in a more shorter cadence, in minute level cadence or sub-minute, and then we put them into HDFS in that case. And then that is used for further processing. And then we also have other streaming engines or other like true streaming jobs that read from Kafka directly. And what was that? Okay, I'll move my pointer around a little bit. Cool. So where were we? Yeah, we have like two streaming jobs, reading from Kafka directly and then putting them back to S3 or HDFS or back to Kafka as well. The other big data source that we have is our online data stores. One is MySQL, and then the other big online data store we have is HBase. So for MySQL, we dump our data pretty often through two mechanisms. One is called Tracker, which takes the MySQL backup dump and then converts them into formats that can be consumed by all our data processing systems. And then the other pipeline for moving data into our data stores is through Watermill, which is a CDC-based data ingestion pipeline. So in that case, we will just send a change log to Kafka and then consolidate them into a single dump or a single like consistent set of data in S3. So usually like Tracker, which is our dump or the consistent dump platform, it will be used for like smaller data. And then for Watermill, we use it for like large data sets, such as our PINS database, for example. And then after everything is stored in S3, we have different systems reading from our data lake and the metastore. So one is the streaming system. It primarily uses HDFS for the data because it sometimes requires higher performance and consistency. And then for batch systems, we directly read and write to S3, and then we use all the open source projects around Hadoop, Hive, and Spark. And then we have also ad hoc systems that rely heavily on Presto, and then Data Hub is something that we built in-house that fronts all the ad hoc or interactive data querying systems. And then that is, again, we have our analytics platform where we are processing data from all our logs and online stores and then put them into or provide insights to our internal data scientists, data analysts for A/B testing analysis, also reporting the metrics to a reporting system where everyone in the company can look at business metrics. And we have funnel analysis using all our data infrastructure, and then some protocol pendants where your partners or advertisers can look at each pin and then get deep level insight into it. So that's our data product. This is what we have in the data platform, but of course, all the data processing systems end-to-end is used by a lot of the product teams to power our product itself. So next, our tech stack, we briefly covered everything, but this is like pretty much ordered in the chronological order that we introduced them. So initially we only had Hive HDFS MapReduce. We were running it on a on AWS itself without using S3 as much. And then at that time, we were mostly doing just reporting. Pinterest, in the very early days, it was mostly just a site where our users could come, save things, and then organize them. So we didn't have that much of a discovery problems like search recommendation, and then that was that. But then later on, we had to develop a lot of the recommendation products or search products or the discovery products. So at that time, Cascading and Scalding came in. So Cascading and Scalding is also an open source project, which is a higher level abstraction on MapReduce at that time. It supports Spark now too, but at that time we were using these to index our pins, build signals, build our recommendation, offline recommendations to power our discovery products. Of course, Hive was not good enough to, or it was not flexible enough to do all that. And then MapReduce was not easy enough to use. And then that afterwards, Spark came in around the time in 2014. So the first use cases were around machine learning, and then it expanded to all the aspects of our product. So it's now used in ads. It's also used in discovery. It's also used in search and recommendation. After a while, we also needed a way to query data more interactively. That's when Presto came in. So Hive mostly ran at this point in 2014, was running based on top of MapReduce, and then it was not fast enough, and it was not interactive enough for the most common use cases that we had, which were pretty simple queries. So that's where we found a domain where we could utilize Presto a lot. And then afterwards, at this time, when we got Presto, there was no streaming at all. We had a little bit of Storm, but it was also not fully productionized because our product and our mindset was mostly batch processing based. But then afterwards, we started to introduce a lot of streaming frameworks or platforms. So that's when we started to invest a lot in Mesos and Aurora as well. So on Aurora and Mesos right now, we run all the Spark streaming jobs. So Spark is running both on Yarn and Mesos. So Mesos, we use it because it better supports long-running Spark streaming jobs out of the box. So this is how how our data platform looks like in general. And then this is a quick status of what our data platform looks like. So we have more than 175 petabytes in our data lake with a lot of Metastore. And then we ingest more than 150 terabytes every day. And then we process like out of the 175 petabyte, we process more than 20 petabytes every day. We have thousands of nodes running big data platform services such as Yarn, Mesos, and Presto, and all the other schedulers that we built. And then we're running like tens of thousands of jobs and queries like each day. So this comes out of hundreds of workflows and thousands of jobs that users defined in our systems. Everything is running on the cloud, meaning we run AWS very heavily. And then the one design choice that we made is, in the early days, we tried to use HDFS as much as possible as a persistent data store. But then we started to decouple compute and storage. So it was much easier for us to operate in the cloud by scaling compute independently from storage. And then there was also a lot higher risk with storing data persistently on HDFS. So when you're running your Hadoop nodes or your data nodes in a data center, when a node dies or when a few things go wrong, and then if, for example, three nodes go down at the same time, which happens rarely, but it still happens, you can't pull out the hard disk and then put them in another computer and then bring up the data node again. But then in a cloud service, that is impossible. So when a node goes down, everything on it is gone. It is not revivable. And then we went through a few iterations or a few instances of when we lost more than three data nodes at the same time. It also shows that these cloud providers, they actually they have more intermittent issues around the nodes, and then they make us or they expect the users to treat the nodes as ephemeral state. So, and then S3 as a cloud storage is very cost effective, and then it is very durable. Another topic on that is S3 is not a real file system and it requires many special handling for data processing. We talked about that a lot in the past where we were like writing our own custom like output committers and then how we were changing all the downstream services like the history server to or the node managers to store all the aggregated logs and history files into S3. But that is all the technical difficulties of S3. But today, I'm mostly going to talk about like how we were, how our platform was interacting with the users more, rather than like how we were solving issues that we were running on cloud itself. So like this model itself helped us a lot on scaling our big data platform very easily on cloud. But then there were other higher level problems that we were solving for our users. So what is self-service, right? At dictionary.com it says it's a system whereby customers select goods for themselves or service their cars by themselves or pay a cashier. So it pretty much is where it's a system where everything runs by itself, and then users can find what they want, and then do what they want from, and then get what they want from their, from the services that we provide. And then that's where we wanted to go to. So the reason this is really important is that big data is not that easy. So it is like the open source projects that we have so far has provided. Or has built a platform that could let companies like us, companies like smaller companies, to build something from nothing, but to run it very smoothly for users, it was still a big challenge. And then it was also very important for a company growing at our pace to keep all our users productive as quickly as possible. Having a user stuck on an issue was a big productivity loss and a lot of opportunity cost for us. And then the most important or another important factor is that companies usually grow much faster than the platform team can. And then if you cannot grow your team's surface with the company's growth pace, which was the case in our instance, there will be more and more support load in your team that you cannot sustain. So these are the reasons why self-service was really important for us, and then that why we pushed for a more self-serving system overall in our platform. And then how do we achieve this, right? So one important thing is that we optimized for all the common user workflows and operations. So we focused on like solving the most important problems first. And then at the same time, we were also building a flexible and extensible platform with clean abstractions and boundaries. So that if you as a user were to extend our platform to run something that was not supported initially in our platform, they would be able to write their own code to support that on our Yarn or on our Mesos clusters, and then they could run them through our supported like scheduling mechanism and ETL mechanisms that we have. And then another important thing for us was to expose very important information as part of the platform so that users could self-serve themselves by understanding what was going on in the platform. So this is one thing that I want to talk about today where running jobs was the most important thing for our users. Our users, they want to get insights that they want to produce some data set that will help them build their feature, like our product feature, build their reports, right? So this is what a general workflow looks like for a user in our system. So they write a job or query, they then run and test the job, and then they schedule the job part of an ETL pipeline so that it continuously generates the data that you need in your feature, and then so that it also like refreshes the data that you want to feed into your features. And then after they do step 1, 2, 3, they do the same thing for another job, like over and over again. And then the question that we got in the very early stage was that, like, how do I do this very effectively and efficiently? Like, that was the only interest that our users had in their mind. And then there are too many ways of running jobs. So you could SSH into a gateway node and then run your jobs over there. Or you can like run a cron job over there to schedule your things. And then you can run also your job commands like Spark Summit, Hadoop Jar, Hive CLI, Beehive, whatever, in your laptop and your development machine. But then also there were users who wanted to programmatically trigger and run jobs from their services. And then we didn't have a good answer in the beginning, and then we wanted to make this a standard streamlined process. So first, we worked on building all the abstractions. So we built a Python libraries where our users, it's pretty much a DSL that describes what a job should do. And then these are the interfaces that we built for job and job execution. So there is an abstraction called job where you can just implement these four things for your job if it's something that you are customizing. If it's a Hive job or a general Spark job or Hive Hadoop job, we already have all the implementation filled out for you. But then if you, for example, today want to run a TensorFlow job in whatever platform you need, you could just implement these methods and then just have them scheduled in one of our workflow engines. And it goes same for the executor. So it has a few methods like these. These are pretty self-explanatory. So what you just need to do to onboard a new compute platform like Mesos Aurora, you just have to write a small method and it's actually a set of methods, and then have your job or your job implementation call them. Another important abstraction we have is the workflow. So when we want to schedule our workflow in our ETL pipeline, you define the workflow as shown in this example. So you provide the name of the job, you provide the definition of the job, which is a Python class that inherits from all our libraries. And then you provide the dependencies. Then once you do this over and over again, you could get a workflow execution, something like that. So you could write this configuration in our code. You could write all the implementation of this in our code. And then once you do a git commit in our platform, we will automatically pick this up and then run it as part of our daily or hourly. You could actually like schedule it in a cadence that you can customize and then run them. So this is how we like provided an abstraction for the users to streamline how they write the job, and then also how they schedule something in our workflows. But we still had the problem of running jobs, how we can run a job programmatically very well and effectively. So the first approach that we had was programmatically like running jobs through SSH. So this is the most straightforward and simple approach. You just, your Python process, which is our abstraction for running jobs, it just spawns an SSH process, and then the SSH process with the command will log into a gateway node, and then it will talk to your resource manager, and then, or whatever Mesos cluster, or Mesos master, and then it will schedule your jobs. But then we had a lot of challenges with this. First of all, this really depends on a reliable SSH connection, which is which is true for most cases. But then while we are running in a cloud environment, there are like weird network events. There are different types of host issues that sometimes drop the SSH connections. And then this also assumes that users can reliably connect to the host using SSH. And then this is a great or a severe security consideration that we had to go through. So a cluster is a very, once you get to the cluster, you could pretty much read everything, delete everything, or also read sensitive data. So we had to make the gateway host secure. And then distributing the SSH keys or making it so that we can only have a certain users or a certain host connect to SSH was extremely hard at running at our scale. So we have more than 100,000 nodes running across all our service, and then it was pretty much impossible to control that. And then there are also non-trivial management of CPU and memory consumption of the job client. So we run our client host in different services. For example, our workflow manager runs all these code paths, and then sometimes the SSH process uses a lot of CPU or memory, and then it was causing issues. And then also on the gateway hosts, the job clients, they sometimes use a lot of memory. Hive CLIs, for example, they read a ton of partitions, and then they do a lot of lists, and then they build a lot of data structure inside the memory, inside the JVM. Spark does the same thing. Sometimes cascading does the same thing. So we were having a lot of OOM kills over there. And then we had to load balance and then handle node failures, but that itself was a large project as well. So while we were considering how we want to solve this problem, we actually started to use the Resource Manager REST API to solve this problem. So we built a custom YARN application based on the distributed shell application that is coming as part of the Hadoop repo. And then after that, we were pretty much treating the resource manager and the shell command as a service. So in this case, we don't have the resource management problem anymore, and then we don't also have the load balancing problem anymore, because YARN manages the resources, the containers. It will kill things if they go over your resource limit, and then it will place the containers where you want, where there are available resources. And then in this approach, our clients, our Python libraries, were keeping state to run and track the progress of these jobs. And then we were using our configuration management infrastructure to propagate infrastructure metadata and all the configuration that we needed to run the jobs in our clusters. And then all these job management logic was embedded in our Python executor library, so that once you had your job defined correctly, everything underneath was running through our code path that we wrote, so that the users didn't have to care about all the implementation details that were happening underneath. So this pretty much looks like this from a high level. So our executor, which is the Python process that runs all the jobs, it will submit a job which runs a shell command. So it is pretty much a paradigm where we just give shell commands to resource manager and then run them. So once the job is submitted, resource manager will bring up a distributed shell application, or our application that we wrote based on distributed shell. And then it will first, as always, bring up an application master, and then that will actually bring up another command container that will run the shell command itself. That goes back to submit the actual job. Like, it will run Spark jar or Spark submit, Hadoop jar, or the Hive CLI to run our jobs, and then our Spark or MapReduce job or the Hive job will actually take place. So by doing this, we effectively separated out all our CLI and all our jobs from the higher level executor or higher level job clients from our Python code path. And then there are a few challenges that we had to go through. One thing is at most once execution. So one of the big problems that we saw over time was that once the shell command container runs, sometimes we saw that the application master of the shell command was actually spawning another container. So what happens if that happens? So it can lead to like multiple instances of the same job running. For example, here we have shell command number 0 and number 1, and they're running the same thing. They're running the same Spark job in this case, and then they're going to do the same thing. They're going to write to the same output path and all. And then this like consumes a lot of unnecessary resources, and then at the end, it will actually make the job fail, or it will like in the worst case, produce incorrect data. And then it was very hard to debug this. Then it was also very hard for our users to debug this. So our solution to this was that, or the problems that we identified was that when the container is exiting with aborted, which could be triggered by many things, but mostly it's triggered when a node manager is in a bad state, which can happen a lot in our clusters where like thousands of nodes are running. And then this, the container exit status will actually trigger a rerun. So a few things that we did was we made it like customizable, the behavior, so that rejects are not retried and retrying the containers. And then because like preemptions are also triggering this condition. Once we solved the unnecessary retries of our containers, we also had to go and then make all our shell commander or shell command application containers non-preemptible. And then we also had to like fix a lot of bugs in the existing RMAM clients. So one big thing was that when the application master was submitting a container, and then when resource manager was allocating them, the application master resource manager client was not cleaning up its state correctly. So when a resource manager failover happens, it was rerunning the containers over and over again. So there were a lot of bug fixes done here, and then now we solved the at most once execution problem. But there was still the cleanup mechanism problem. So in this it's kind of a distributed system right now. So an application master runs the shell command, and the shell command will, in this case, the example is running multiple MapReduce jobs. This is possible when you run a Hive job or when you run a cascading job that is based on MapReduce. And then what happens is that the shell command ran something, but then no one else in the whole picture here wouldn't know what the job they submitted were, or whether they even submitted when the shell command would be killed or would die or would crash. So this was a big challenge. And then what we did eventually was that we were using the yarn application tag as a consistent metadata for all the application and all the jobs that are like running throughout in our system. So we would generate a tag at the time we submit the job, and then that tag will be propagated to all the jobs that we are running through configurations like these. There are configurations for Spark, there's configuration for MapReduce, and there are configurations and custom code that we injected for our custom applications as well. And then when something happens, when, for example, some part of our applications crash, we could reliably identify all the pieces that were running part of this application and part of this job, and then clean them up consistently and cleanly. The challenges of this approach was that we were running a very fat Python client for job submission and lifecycle management and infrastructure discovery. And then another problem was that we were only keeping the ephemeral state of the client. So when The client dies, for example, we would lose all the information about jobs that are running in our systems. And we had a lot of complex job management logic. We couldn't make it portable to other services that are running Java or Go. And then like all the infrastructure complexity was exposed directly to the users. We had to manage like hundreds of clients to run this, to make this run correctly. And then that itself, managing hundreds of hosts and then having monitoring them and then making them run correctly was by itself a problem that we had to work on separately. And then, of course, we didn't have any secure authentication methods. So after that, we actually started to build a RESTful service that can run jobs. So for example here, we identified this as a common job statement or state machine in lifecycle so that this could be used generically throughout the company. So with our REST service, we had secure authentication ACL from a central entry point. We were able to implement all the abstraction paradigms that we had in our Python clients by defining job types like command job, long-running job, spark job, like Hive job, whatever. And then we were able to abstract the execution logic below it by making it customizable for anyone who wants to bring a new infrastructure. So in this case, job states are preserved in an accessible store so that we don't have to rely on the clients to keep track of the state. And then everything in this service was tightly managed, and it was much easier to maintain and sustain. So this is a high-level design overview of how it looks like. We made the service itself very stateless, and then we have a separate state store so that we can run multiple of these job services and scale them separately from the store. And then right now there are many clients that are running running jobs through our REST service, and then there are many backends that are supporting this job submission mechanism right now. So this is pretty much it for the REST submission service. So we added another job service over there, and then everything below is still the same, the things that we built on Yarn to make everything run as a job, as a service. But then, this is pretty much the end of the journey where we made very flexible command jobs run on our clusters. But then, new problems were happening. So users came coming to us because they were just running, writing jobs, and then they weren't able to understand all these questions. Why is my job taking such a long time? Where is it spending time? And what is the resource utilization of the job? And then there were we also identified other users of our platform at that time. So we were getting questions from finance teams: why you are running so many EC2 nodes? Why are you, or when, or how many nodes are you going to run next month, next quarter, next year? And then because when users were adding jobs, the compute and storage was being added pretty much semi-automatically. It was just you do a git commit and then everything was provisioned behind the scene. So this flexibility and freedom gave us headache in the after in all the cost discussions, and then also understanding what's going on actually in our systems. So then we started to build a lot of visibility tooling and frameworks into our platform. So one big thing that we did was that we were moving a lot of the history and counters to a queryable format so that users or us could go in and then identify issues or identify how the job was running. And then this is a big paradigm we shifted to at this time. So we were pretty much emitting so much metrics to our visibility pipelines. We were getting reports, but then we never actually made it possible to have all these data queryable. So that's one theme, and then one big lessons that we learned in our process, that like you can have multiple reports and you can have many visibility reports and tools to report on many common things, but then like even if you cover the most common things, there will be like more questions. And then just to answer that question, the most effective way was to make everything queryable. And then that problem itself was a big data problem. So most of our queries or data is Hive, are like stored as a Hive table and used, or Presto is used to query most of these data. And then another big thing that we were doing is tracking all the resource usage. So we were extracting a lot of these resource usage from our queryable history files, but then later on we added on Spark and other Yarn applications, so we changed our approach a little bit so that we are ingesting all the audit logs from resource managers so that when an application finishes, we exactly know what happened to the application. So this covers everything that is running in the Yarn cluster, and then we were reporting on what workflows and what jobs are consuming how much resources in the cluster by all the owners, and then these owners were being aggregated to organization levels. So this, after this, we were free from the discussion of like why we were using so much instances, but the discussion shifted to our users. So like, different teams were asking our users why they were running so many jobs and why they were consuming so much resources. At that time, also these users came to us and then asked us why or where their jobs are running or spending a lot of time. So we built a pipeline where users could turn on profiling in their jobs as a JVM option or different options in different types of applications. And then they could write a pipeline where they can produce a flame graph like this. So after this was done, they were able to understand what the bottlenecks were, what the time sinks were, but then more importantly, we were able to find a lot of interesting problems. We were using this for to debug our platform issues. We found a lot of, we automatically found a lot of issues or a lot of expensive regular expressions. We found a lot of unnecessary two-string calls in all around our code. And then this by itself was a big win. And then after we solved the compute problem, we also had a storage problem. Storage problem was a more, open problem because to get to a compute, you had to go through some hoops, but then writing to S3 was, or writing to a cloud storage is so easy that you can just write and then people forget about it. They write a test job, they forget about it, they never look back, and then that's how our storage footprint was growing. And then S3 or AWS, they don't give you reports on jobs or on like S3 like data files or tables that you could use to identify the usages by your jobs or by owners, right? So we had to build that out ourselves. What we were using was, we were discussing with the Stream team for a bit, and then they were open to provide a inventory, S3 object inventory, that we can process to get all the visibility into our systems. So they made this feature public later on, and then what it is that the object inventory will have all the objects in your bucket, and then it will show you the object, it will show how big it is, how when it was created, and all that. And then we are aggregating these data into prefixes and data sets and tables and partitions so that we can build reports on top of it, and then we can have users actually query them so that they can get insights into like how they're using their data and then how their data is going to grow. And another breakthrough or another question that arises after this was like we were reporting all these things and then users were asking like who is writing the data. So And then why is this data like useful, or is it even being used? So at that time, we were looking at how we can propagate this information, and then we wrote a variant of this Jira where we could tag all the workflows and jobs, the metadata that we care about, into all the request logs. And then we were able to aggregate these and then make a Hive table out of it and then report things again. And then this was used to propagate all the ownership information from jobs and then also power our data lineage graph. So at this stage, we were able to understand what jobs were doing like computationally and then what they were putting into our storage. So this is a big learning that we got. So overall, like while we were building a scalable big data platform, we realized that big data is not that easy, especially at the scale that we run on. But we can make it easier with abstractions and tools. Building a self-service tool or self-service platform will give you a long runway. And then in the process, you have to focus on the most important things of your platform and then provide like clean abstractions and then make it very easy to extend it. But then the other part that we had to learn the hard way was that we needed visibility, transparency, and then have a way to put accountability to users who are using the system so that we have all the checks and balances to build a healthy company and then also have a healthy business. And then this was a super hard part where we could do this all, but then like doing it at the scale that we wanted to do with 600 and more engineers running like 10,000 jobs and then thousands of nodes, that was not a straightforward thing to do operationally. So we made everything automatic and then made it systematic end to end so that everything reports by itself, and then data visibility is all available in a Hive table so that it can be consumed by everyone. And this was pretty much it of my talk. So hopefully you can discover interesting ideas at Pinterest or in the conference, and then I'll be around, I think. Sorry about the technical glitch in the beginning. I'll be around to take any questions, and find me wherever you want in the conference, and then we can talk more. Thank you.